Wilberforce probably expected Newton to encourage him to leave politics for the ministry, but if so, the older man surprised him. Newton told him that God had placed him in Parliament for such a time as this, and that he might be able to do more good for the cause of Christ in the public world of politics than in the more cloistered world of pastoral ministry. Upon reflection, Wilberforce decided this was a word from the Lord for him and committed himself to representing Jesus in the political arena. As a politician and a Christian, Wilberforce took his job seriously. He educated himself and involved himself in nearly every issue of the day. In many ways, he was fairly conservative, but his conscience moved him so powerfully that if any issue seemed to have a moral component to it, he'd give no thought to voting against his own party and political allies. He always had a tender heart toward the poor and the oppressed, and he spent much time and effort throughout his life to promote societies and organizations which would give aid to such people, or in some cases animals. England was a rough, callous society in those days, and compassion and tenderness toward the unfortunate was rarely seen, particularly in Wilberforce's early days. But by the end of his life, he and his friends and associates would have changed all that to a large degree. One of the keys to Wilberforce's political achievements was his ability to draw men and women to his causes. He was one of those rare types who was entirely likable. Somewhat like the former President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, almost everybody liked him. You might disagree with his politics, you might vote against him on every issue he brought up, but you could hardly help but like the small man whose sense of humor and free and easy manner was highly attractive. Simply put, William Wilberforce had charisma, and he used this asset like a mighty weapon, a powerful tool to achieve what he wanted. And what he wanted were laws, decrees, and regulations which would make life easier for the poor and the prisoners, the widows and the orphans, and especially for the Africans who are suffering most of all at the hands of the British. He could never have accomplished much on his own, but his charisma and his cheerful and optimistic Christian faith drew others toward him and resulted in powerful alliances of men, women, and groups which worked tirelessly and effectively to bring about social reform and relief for the downtrodden. Metaxas writes, "Wilberforce labored to reduce the number of crimes punishable by hanging. He worked with Quaker Elizabeth Fry to bring about penal reform for women prisoners, with Romilly on many other efforts at penal reform, including improvement on the harsh penal code of the time. Wilberforce referred to floggings in the army as an object of my abomination, and cruelty of any kind, whether against slaves or prisoners or sailors in the Royal Navy or animals, always touched him and roused him to action. He was so outspoken about cruelty, abuse, poverty, and oppression that in his later years he was known as the conscience of the nation. Cruel practices which had gone on for centuries and of which everyone else had simply accepted as normal were blasted by Wilberforce and their evil so magnified that people felt someone ought to do something about it. And eventually, Parliament did just that. It didn't happen immediately, but within a few years of his election to Parliament, Wilberforce came to see slavery and the slave trade as the greatest evils of all. The only reason he didn't see it quicker is that, like most of the British, he had no clue what was really involved in capturing and transporting Africans to serve as slaves in the West Indies. When Wilberforce learned of the terrible atrocities that were being committed just in getting the Africans to their place of bondage, he was horrified. In those days, an attempt at total abolition of slavery would never have succeeded. Those who hated slavery knew this and decided that the wisest course would be to outlaw the slave trade. They assumed that once all slave trading and slave transport was ended, slavery would die a natural death. But more importantly, they realized that at this time, abolition of the slave trade, not slavery itself, was the only realistic possibility. And so they shelved the idea of total abolition of slavery and concentrated all their energies on outlawing the practice of transporting slaves from Africa to anywhere in the British Empire. It was an uphill battle. Major British companies were making enormous profits through the slave trade. In addition, the general populace of England was both unaware and unconcerned about what was happening to Africans in distant places. A major campaign to educate the people of the horrors and the brutality of just what was happening at the hands of greedy, brutal British men of means would not be enough, however. It would take something more. It would require a politician of influence who would take it on himself to raise the matter in the halls of Parliament and press the issue again and again like a ceaseless battering ram, until at last the doors that preserved the slave trade cracked and disintegrated. All the events that led to William Wilberforce becoming that man are not entirely known, but one of the major factors was that he was essentially chosen by the leaders of England's abolitionist movement. Several of the key men and women in the emerging movement to ban the slave trade took notice of young Wilberforce and recognized in him a kindred spirit. He was a serious Christian, as were nearly all of them. He was a thoroughly decent and compassionate man, and he was quickly becoming known as a friend of the poor and oppressed. Wilberforce was invited to one of their gatherings and was asked if he would consider leading the charge in the political arena. Most of the abolitionists were not politicians, and their efforts were focused on changing the public attitude toward slavery. They did this through the dissemination of reports of the horrendous atrocities that were continually done as Africans were ripped from their homes, crammed into ships in unspeakably miserable conditions, and sent to foreign lands where they would live out their lives, usually short ones, as slaves of men who treated them as nothing more than oxen. These abolitionists were sincere, intelligent, and devout, but they were not politicians. They had almost no influence with the members of Parliament who made the laws which shaped British policies and practices. They needed someone on the inside, and they were convinced that Wilberforce was the ideal man for the job. They could not have chosen more wisely. Wilberforce had developed some powerful connections. His best friend, William Pitt, was now the Prime Minister of England, who favored outlawing the slave trade, although it was not by any means his highest priority. In addition, Wilberforce's natural charm and charisma made him one of the most likable, popular MPs of his time. Beyond all this, he was a born orator and could give stirring speeches in Parliament like almost nobody else. William Pitt, an outstanding speaker himself, said Wilberforce possessed the greatest natural eloquence of all the men I ever knew. Once when Wilberforce got up on a table to make a public speech, one of his listeners reported, "I saw what seemed a mere shrimp mount upon the table, but as I listened he grew and grew until the shrimp became a whale." Wilberforce told the eager abolitionists that he would be willing to lead the charge in the House of Commons once he had properly prepared and thoroughly studied the matter, and if no better spokesman could be found. The first qualifier simply required a bit of research, and as to them finding someone better, there was no chance of that. They could have waded and scoured English politics for the next 1,000 years, and they would have found no one more perfectly suited, both by temperament, abilities, and spiritual passion, for the task. And so began a 20-year campaign to bring the wheels of the immoral, ungodly, and wretched British slave trade to a screeching halt. Of course, William had no idea it would take 20 years. At the beginning, he seemed overly optimistic that the matter could quickly be studied and reported, and that the ugliness of transporting African slaves from their homes to foreign places of bondage would surely bring about a change of the public mind, and soon a change of the minds of the politicians. Wilberforce was such a thoroughly decent, compassionate, and empathetic man, he didn't realize the power of inbuilt prejudices among people who simply weren't close to being as decent and compassionate as he was. Millions of pounds were being made from slaves every year, and that wealth was trickling down to many who weren't directly involved. And when big money is involved, consciences are conveniently hardened and ineffective, even in the face of the most powerful evidence of cruelty and injustice. Wilberforce and his friends began a campaign to inform the public of the exact nature of the slave trade, particularly the cruelty involved in transporting the slaves. The more they learned, the more horrified they became. Africans were jammed and crammed into ships until they could hold no more. Usually the slaves were kept in the belly of the ship, in such close proximity that there was no room for them to sleep on their backs. These areas were not only cramped but often stifling and nearly airless, and disease was rampant. One of the most common factors was diarrhea, which resulted in overfilling the few buckets placed around for the slaves to relieve themselves. Soon the floor of the slaves' quarters would be filled with sewage and vomit, and emit such terrible smells that few people apart from the crew itself could stand to be on board the ships for more than a few minutes. Women and girls were brought on board naked and trembling and were frequently raped by the crew. It was said that a slave ship was part bedlam and part brothel. That slaves would die on these journeys was a given. The ship owners allowed for a certain amount of business losses, but if the death toll rose too high, they'd blame the captain and go looking for another. Ironically, when the abolition of the slave trade first began to be publicly debated, both in Parliament and in the public discourse, one of the defenses of the slave traders was that they were actually doing the Africans a favor by taking them away from a harsh life in Africa, treating them humanely, and upgrading their lifestyle in their new lives as plantation slaves. This was a flagrant lie, of course, but in the beginning of the debate there was enough general ignorance on the issue that many believed it. Some described the slaves singing and dancing on the ships as though they were happy pilgrims. Well, there was singing and dancing, but not like they suggested. The singing was a mournful way for the Africans to express their sorrow, and the dancing was done by demand of the crew. They would bring slaves on deck and force them to dance by threat of the whip. This was thought to provide exercise and keep them healthy, and also provided amusement for the crew. Indeed, disease and death filled the ships to such an extent that even the crew was affected. In a deadly irony, the abuse poured out on the poor slaves led to fast-spreading contagious diseases which did not limit themselves to the slaves' quarters. It was estimated that the mortality rate among the crew on a typical slave ship was 25% annually. In some cases, the death toll among the crew was higher, percentage-wise, than it was among the slaves. Wilberforce and his friends set about to put the record straight. Evidence of the monstrosity of the slave trade was not lacking. Within a few years, they gathered mountains of documents, testimonies, and first-hand reports from both former slaves, repentant slave ship crew, and others who were exposed to the nature of slave transportation, until they eviscerated their opponents. The defense that slaves were happy to leave Africa and were treated humanely was so thoroughly demolished that before long, those who had personal interest in seeing the slave trade continue had to stop their mouths, at least with this particular ploy.